8. It actually is the very beginning, I mean, the very end of chapter 7, verse 53 is where you really ought to begin chapter 8. Remember, the chapters and verses were added much later. In fact, they were added so late that we even know the people who added them. And they often did a good job of figuring out where the chapters and verse divisions should be, but sometimes they messed up. For instance, verse 53 really is part of chapter 8, next chapter.
Mine has it like that.
Yours has it that way. Your King James won't.
Is then each went to his own home. Is that what yours says?
Yes. Yeah. It's one sentence, you see. Then each of them went home while Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. That's one sentence. And that's the way it reads in Greek. So that really ought to be the way in which it's done, but the King James does it a little differently. It ends chapter 7, own home, and then it begins out with, Jesus went unto the Mount of Olives. So it's a little different how it's how the versification and chapter division.
Yeah,
occurs.
This starts one in the middle of the sentence.
Yeah, which is how mine starts at 2, with the word while.
Yeah.
And that's probably the best rendition of it. It's just a poor chapter and verse division. Just as an interesting note, this story, the woman caught in adultery, is not found in all copies of John's Gospel and not in all copies in this location.
In the earliest manuscripts.
I'm sorry?
It says in the earliest manuscripts, this is they didn't have John 753 and
8:11. Right. 8:11. Yes. The note in my Bible margin says the most ancient authorities lack 753 through 8:11. Other authorities add the passage here or after 7:36 or after 21 verse 25 or after Luke chapter 21 verse 38 with many variations of text. Some mark the passage as being doubtful, but they included it anyway. And you can, looking in my Greek New Testament in the textual apparatus, I notice there are many references to the manuscripts and what they read. The text as it is found in most of our translations, which included here, can be found in several old manuscripts, D, Gamma, and 892. There are many variations, and all the many different variations of the reading. Sometimes it places it in the margin, sometimes it places it elsewhere in John, as that note said, sometimes it places it in Luke. And in some copies of John, it simply isn't there at all. The likelihood is that this story did not exist in the final edition of John's Gospel, but got added in. Studies of the story indicate that it is very much characteristic of Jesus. The language is interestingly Johannine, meaning that it sounds like John. It's not uncommon to John. But it also could read pure and appropriate in the Synoptic Gospels, like Luke. Since it floated around in the textual history of the early New Testament transmission, it seems likely that it probably wasn't authentic. However, it reads like an authentic story. And many New Testament textual critics, scholars of the formation of the New Testament, believe that while it wasn't originally part of John's Gospel, it is nevertheless an authentic story of Jesus that got added in here and eventually stuck here, although there's a lot of debate as to where it actually belongs. Where it came from during the period between the writing of the Gospels and it getting added in is another question altogether. It could have survived in the oral account. You've got to remember, during the early church, during Paul's day, for instance, up until the late 60s, for the most part, the Gospels had remained unwritten. They were, the stories of Jesus were told orally. Early on, sometime after his death and resurrection, but before about 50 AD, somebody, and some early church fathers say that it was Matthew, wrote down the teachings of Jesus, the sayings of Jesus. Jesus tells this parable, Jesus tells that parable, Jesus said this, Jesus said that. And a collection of the sayings of the Lord, which circulated independently of any other account and was used primarily by traveling evangelists in Palestine and then later in Asia Minor in Greece in the telling of the Jesus story. The Gospels were written beginning in the late 60s, first Mark, and then Matthew and Luke, which included a lot of teaching material that wasn't found in Mark. And Matthew and Luke appeared to have used Mark and, independently, a teaching source, a written collection of Jesus' sayings. Matthew and Luke both seem to use Mark as their basic chronological outline and a teaching source, the sayings of Jesus, which they inserted at different places in different ways inside of their Gospels. John is different from the Synoptics in that he tells the teachings of Jesus differently. As we said earlier, in the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus teaches by parables. In the Johannine Gospel, Jesus teaches by dialogues, give and take, discussions back and forth with the Pharisees and the scribes and the disciples and other people. We've seen that in many different occasions. We saw that with the woman at the well. We saw that in the story from John chapter 6 after the feeding of the 5,000. We saw this give and take conversation back and forth between Jesus and the Jewish leadership and then Jesus and the disciples. The dialogic type of teaching method was an ancient Hebraic method of teaching, and especially an ancient Hebraic method of writing down the teachings of one's master, one's rabbi. So it's not an uncommon idea. Many New Testament scholars prefer Matthew, Mark, and Luke because, firstly, they seem to reflect Matthew and Luke, that earlier source of written down teachings of Jesus in parables, and hence they believe it's more accurate to what Jesus actually said. Some New Testament scholars love Matthew, Mark, and Luke and that teaching source that's found in Matthew and Luke for the teachings of Jesus, but they don't disregard John and believe that John reflects an independent teaching tradition about the sayings of Jesus, which was transmitted independently of the saying source, which was common behind Matthew and Luke. I tend to follow that school of thought that doesn't disregard Matthew and Luke's teaching account, but also doesn't disregard John's teaching account, and views them as separate ways of communicating the same kinds of thing. What we have in the woman caught in adultery is very much like one of those stories about Jesus, which got into, essentially makes up the content of Mark, but also is didactic. It's a teaching narrative, so it sounds a lot like John, but also a lot like Luke. And so that's probably the reason why it ended up in some copies in Luke, but in most copies when it shows up at all, it shows up in John.
What I like about it, though, is stuff like this probably was part of their culture.
Mm-hmm.
Stoning the woman caught in
adultery. It reflects the Jewish culture at the time.
Well, and the Muslim, too.
Absolutely no. Well, Muslim is way after the time of Jesus, but you're right. The Muslim culture today, and since Islam was founded, has a very harsh code of conduct, particularly with regards to women. But it's very much in character of the day, of the Hebrew day in which Jesus lived. And what Jesus does in the story is very much in character both with Jesus as depicted in John's Gospel and Jesus as depicted in the Synoptics. So there is absolutely no reason to doubt its authenticity, just its source. I tend to think that it was communicated orally, a story about Jesus that was communicated orally, probably told in sermons many times by the people who saw it and then by the people who heard them preach it, like Mark's gospel originally was, but never actually made it into any of the other sources until John's gospel was published and the synoptics were already in circulation. And the need to include the story became obvious. And so it got included. And this is the place in chapter 8 where it usually gets included. So let's go ahead and read through it, and then we'll take a look at its elements and talk about a couple of things that it tells us and a couple of things that it doesn't tell us. Then each of them went home while Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Early in the morning he came again to the temple. So this is in Jerusalem. He came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and began to teach them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and making her stand before all of them, they said to him, "Teacher," actually that's Rabbi, "this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now, in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now, what do you say?" They said this to test him, so that they might have some charge to bring against him. And Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let anyone among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." And once again he bent down and wrote on the ground. When they heard it, they went away, one by one, beginning with the elders. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus straightened up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, sir." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way, and from now on do not sin again."
That's powerful.
Very
good
powerful.
For you, Jesus.
Good for you, Jesus. Attaboy, Jesus.
I forgot to say what happened to the guy, but...
Well, yes. That's the thing that gets me every time I read this story. Look at what happens. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery. And making her stand before all of them, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery." Now, the verbs there are very much present tense. Now, caught is past, but she was caught committing adultery. Now, the last time I looked, it takes at least two to commit adultery. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
They probably couldn't catch the guy.
Where's the guy?
It's okay for him to do it.
Actually, not according to the law of Moses. Indeed, according to the law of Moses, not only is the woman to be stoned, so is the man.
But they didn't mention that.
Totally ignored that. Now, if they caught her in the very act of adultery, then he was there. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that they heard that she had done it, or they caught her after the fact, or they had accusations filed against her that she had been engaged in adultery, and they went and arrested her at her home after it was all over with. No, they caught her doing the deed. They caught her in the midst of the trick. Where's the guy?
Maybe he was a friend of theirs and they let him go.
Maybe he was a friend of theirs and they let him go. Or, as I tend to think, and as some scholars tend to think, he was one of the people in the crowd demanding that she be stoned.
Probably.
What was Jesus writing on the ground with his finger? Look at that part.
That's what I was wondering.
Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let anyone among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." And once again he bent down and wrote on the ground. Other ancient authorities add the phrase, "the sins of each of them."
The sins of each of them.
Now that's an addition that's not in the oldest and best, but it's interpretive.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody probably wrote out in the margin one day as it was being read, or as they were reading it in their copy that then got later copied into the body text, they wrote "the sins of each of them" as an interpretation of what Jesus was writing. But what did Jesus write with his finger? Well, if you look at how it, the phrase that he wrote with his finger in the ground, bracketing the statement, "let anyone among you who is without sin be the first to cast a stone at her," you can see how the and then when he writes on the ground again in the dirt, the people leave one by one, beginning with the elders. That occasioned a reader to write into the margin "the sins of them," because that would give body to A, what he was doing, and B, why they responded the way they did. I think that's close to right. I think that interpretation is not entirely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's even more specific than that. If she was a woman caught in the act of adultery, in many cases in that culture, it wouldn't be a one-time event. All right? This was someone who had, in essence, a shingle out, and that was what she did.
Mm-hmm.
That was her profession. And she had, therefore, probably committed adultery with a great number of the men in the community. Very probably a great number of the men who were gathered there to stone her, hoping to kill her, possibly to protect themselves.
Yeah, you would think that would be a dangerous career for somebody who's going to be stoned to
entirely
death.
Entirely dangerous.
If you get caught.
It's still dangerous.
It's still dangerous today.
Golly.
But it is the oldest, the second oldest profession. Clergy is the oldest.
Really?
Well, that's a joke.
Okay.
We were both prostitutes, they say. Since. But I think that it's not an unreasonable leap to think that if she was caught in the act, the guy is nowhere to be found. Perhaps he's in the crowd, and indeed, not only him, but all the other guys in the crowd who are so eager to get rid of her, they're trying to get rid of the evidence against themselves.
Mm-hmm. Probably.
Let's stone her, let's get rid of her, let's execute this law literally and viciously right now, not just out of righteous anger at having caught her in the act of adultery. If that were the case, where was the guy?
Mm-hmm.
No, that had nothing to do with it. There was something personal involved.
Mm-hmm.
And notice how they leave. When they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the elders, beginning with
the presbyteroi.
The older leaders or heads of the community. Let's see, it's verse 9. Let me look. Make sure what word they use. Yeah, presbyterion.
Mm-hmm.
The same word, presbyter, that is the office that I hold,
mm-hmm.
The order that I hold. I'm an elder. And that's an official office in the church and in the ancient world and in the Jewish world. An elder was not just some old guy, it was also a leader in the synagogue, a leader of the religious community.
Yes, they are teachers of the law and the Pharisees.
Yes.
They're
they were the first to leave.
Big guys, yeah.
Yeah, the big guys. And they were the first to leave. And the speculation is, and has been for a long time, since one of the earliest preachers on this passage, and he said some things that were very wrong, but he said some things that were very right too. A fellow by the name of John Chrysostom, Chrysostom means golden tongue, because he was a fantastic preacher. He was one of the earliest great preachers of the church whose sermons were written down, and we have them to today. He was preaching in the 300s AD, and he was bishop of Constantinople. And an amazing preacher. And his speculation was is that Jesus was writing in the dirt the names of those who were her customers.
Mm-hmm. That's what I had heard before.
Mm-hmm. That comes from John Chrysostom.
Because, I mean, why did they make a point of saying he was writing in the dirt?
Mm-hmm.
If it didn't have something
bearing
to do with a story.
He's just not doodling away.
Didn't say he was doodling. He said he was
writing.
And then he went back to writing again.
Mm-hmm.
So.
He was literally writing in the dirt, on the ground. Well, that's that verse 8. Let's see. I'm curious. Yeah? Grafein, to write. Literally, it's intentional scribing. And he's writing on the ground something specific. And he does it before and after the statement, let the one who was without sin cast the first stone.
So if he's writing all their names down, they all had to leave.
Yes.
Then it's kind of like today we say people that live in glass houses don't throw stones.
Exactly. We get it from here. Yeah. We get that saying from here. It's a modification built upon it. The idea being that each one of those men literally were her customers. And they were trying to get rid of her, essentially to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this can be interpreted, this part of the story can be applied many different ways. Be careful about being too zealous. Usually if the person who is most outspoken against something often has done it themselves.
They may get caught like the guy.
Remember the senator?
Like the senator.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. That does happen sometimes. So watch out.
Like Shakespeare, methinks you doth
protest
too much.
Yes, precisely. Mm-hmm. So there's that aspect in it. The whole principle is very true, though. Even if what he was writing was just general sins of the people who were gathered there, his maxim is central to the gospel, that he who is without sin cast the first stone. If you are without sin, you have the right to judge another of sin. But if you are a sinner yourself, who are you to demand punishment of another? All right.
If we followed that with the law, nobody would get punished.
No one would.
Yeah.
No one would.
Nobody.
You're exactly right.
Would,
but in the church, we are not to be about the law.
Mm-hmm.
We're about grace. And this is a story about grace.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Notice the very end. Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? She said, no one, Lord. Sir, Kurios. And Jesus said, neither do I condemn you. Now, she was caught in the very act of adultery. If Jesus was writing down all of the names of her customers, she was very much an adulteress.
Mm-hmm. She was guilty.
She was guilty. And yet, he says, neither do I condemn you. And by extrapolation, you could say the one who had the right to throw the stone at her was him.
Mm-hmm.
Or as the old joke, the Roman Catholic joke, Jesus says, let he who is without sin cast the first stone, and then this rock goes flying by Jesus' head and smashes the woman in the face, and he goes, Mom! That's a Roman Catholic joke. But in point of fact, Jesus would have the right to condemn. But he says, neither do I condemn you.
Yeah, but he also has the fact that his mother was almost stoned.
Well, considering the fact that he was not the product of his mom and his stepdad, and that she also conceived prior to their marriage, you could even make that argument. I hadn't thought of that before. Thank you. He could have been speaking out of that own personal experience. The realization that even if she did it for money and had done it with many customers, ostensibly she committed essentially the same sin that his mother would have been accused of. And his dad didn't put her away. How could he be judgmental of this woman here now? At least that's an interesting argument. I'd never thought of that before. "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" And she said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you." The one who had the right to condemn did not. The one who knew her sin and had the right to condemn did not. That can't be missed. So many Christians today want to rush to the last sentence. And they don't want to linger for a moment there. "Neither do I condemn you." Jesus, who had the right to condemn, Jesus, who has the right to condemn us for our sins, doesn't. Instead, he says, "Neither do I condemn you. And now, go your way. And from now on, do not sin again. Do not sin anymore."
So she was smart. She'd take his advice. He's offering forgiveness.
He is not just offered forgiveness, he's forgiven.
And,
I mean, there's, you know, whenever you land and you're on an airplane, you land at a new airport, says, "We want to welcome you to DFW Airport." Okay, welcome me. Don't just say, "We want to." Do it. Yeah. We welcome you. That's the stupid utilization of language in English. Here, the words are matter of fact. And then in verse 11, it's not just a suggestion. "I think it would be a good idea if you went and sinned no more."
Mm-hmm.
It's a command. It's in the imperative.
Mm-hmm.
"Go and sin no more. From now on, do not sin again." It's a recognition, yes, she was an adulteress. Yes, she had broken the law. "Neither do I condemn you, but go and sin no more." There is the ability to change. That forgiveness enables change. The gift of grace, first of all, in rescuing her from those who would stone her. Secondly, in saying, "Neither do I condemn you," the gift of grace empowers a response of transformation. Go and sin no more. It wasn't a suggestion. It wasn't a wishful thinking. I hope you won't sin again. It was an imperative statement. You will go and you will sin no more. That's a very powerful affirmation. But it's impossible to expect it. And it's impossible to actually say it without first having the gift of grace, the gift of unearned favor with, "Neither do I condemn you." That's because God, and in this case Jesus, is always the initiator of our change. If we change, if we are going to change and sin no more in a certain way and some specific issue, we can't do it on our own. It only happens through God's grace. When God's grace moves into our lives, we are truly forgiven. We accept that forgiveness, and then we become transformed. It's the heart of the Methodist Wesleyan doctrine of sanctification. The idea that if we change, if we stop sinning in some respects in our lives, we do so not because of us and our own will, but because of Jesus and what Jesus has done for us in giving us grace. The story is extremely powerful. The story may not belong in John's gospel contextually, but it certainly belongs in the gospel as a whole. It has to be contained and maintained, and I thank God that none of the translators that I've ever seen or the textual apparatus that I've ever looked at has ever assumed that it doesn't actually belong in the story itself, even if there's question as to its history. Now, the woman caught in adultery. Who has been identified as the woman caught in adultery in the tradition of the church?
Mary Magdalene.
Mary Magdalene. We have Gregory the Great, Pope of Rome, to thank for that misidentification. He was utterly wrong in that. The Roman Catholic Church has themselves recognized that Mary Magdalene was not a prostitute.
Because all they said was she was a woman of how many devils?
A bunch.
Why?
She was delivered, but the gospel never identifies Mary of Magdala as being any kind of prostitute or an adulterer. And that is the tradition that evolved around her thanks to Gregory the Great's connection. But he was in error in doing so, and thank God John Paul II stated as much. He, in one of his sermons a bunch of years ago, when he was in the middle of the message, he essentially said that connection is wrong. Biblically, there's no basis for saying that. None. It's not here. It's not anywhere. So this isn't Mary Magdala. Even though you can see it in movies that it's her, they always make the connection in various movies, and you hear it all the time in proclamations about her, but it's not her. It's not her. In fact, one of the claims of the Da Vinci Code nonsense is that this story had been removed from the textual history of the early New Testament because it was an attempt to hide Mary Magdala's connection to Jesus in this event and downplay her role. How can you downplay the role of the person who was consistent in all four Gospels as the first evangelist? Mary Magdalene is in all four Gospels. They all disagree on many issues, especially with regard to the resurrection of Jesus. But the one thing they have in common in all four Gospels is she is the first evangelist. She's the first one to proclaim Jesus risen from the dead.
And if this would have been her, they would have named her, because they named her and everything else.
Exactly. Precisely. So the church was never downplaying Mary Magdalene, ever. And this story was not removed because it's about her. That's nonsense. The Da Vinci Code is nonsense. And this idea is nonsense. The story is simply one that floated around in the oral tradition and got added in here. And it's a powerful, fantastic story, and one that we shouldn't gloss over. Okay, let's go to after the death and resurrection of Jesus.
Where are we going to?
We're going to chapter 21. And let's begin at verse 15. This is after the death and resurrection of Jesus. The disciples have gone back up to Galilee. They're on Lake Tiberias at the shore now. And Jesus has appeared to them post-resurrection. And they've had breakfast. When they had finished breakfast, verse 15, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" And he said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Feed my lambs." A second time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And he said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And Peter felt hurt because he had said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep." Wow. Three times Jesus asked him this question. Three times he asked him, "Do you love me?" Why might this have happened?
Does that have anything to do with Peter denying him three times?
It's preparing him.
The denial three times, the question
three
times.
Strengthening his faith?
One fascinating interpretation is that since the denial occurred three times, the question is posed three times to erase the denial.
Oh.
To erase each one. That's one idea.
Yeah.
to build his faith, to build him up, yes, but it seems to have had the opposite effect. Mm-hmm. The third time he's hurt that he's been asked this question yet again.
Well, was it in this? Was the same words used each one of those in the Greek?
No.
So it's three different ways he asked it.
Not quite. The first two times, let's read the questions again. The first time, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? That time, in verse 15, the word is agape, agapas me. Do you love me? Agapas me? Agape love. The high, ultimate, divine form of love. The love of God which gives because of the nature of God to give it. And that we give because God gives it to us to give. Unconditional love. The love that considers the need of the one who is beloved more than your own need. That's a powerful love. It's divine love. That's the first time. His response, however, is not as obvious as that. Because while the question in verse 15 of Jesus to Peter is, do you love me, agape? His response is with the second level of love in Greek, phileo. The city Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. Phileo is the kind of love that people have for each other where it's almost like you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. The love you give because you have they love you or that so they will love you back. Friendship kind of love. Not agape
reciprocal
love. Reciprocal love. Not agape love, but friendship love. Some people would prefer this to be translated as, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I like you. In English, that's gets closer to the idea, but it's more than just a like.
Mm-hmm.
You might say, do you love me more than these? Yes, Lord, you know that I'm very fond of you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay, he didn't answer with the same word. In verse 15, Jesus' question is, agapes me? And his response back is, kurie su orias hate phileose. You know that I love you, phileo love. You know that I like you. You know that I am very fond of you. So his response is not with the same word.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be the reason that Jesus asks him the second time.
Mm-hmm.
So second time, verse 16. A second time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Simon, Ioannou, agapes me? Do you love me? Agapes me? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And the response is, nai kurie su orias hate phileose. You know that I am very fond of you. Phileo again. His reply is with phileo, not agape, phileo. Jesus asks, agape me? You know I phileo you. Agape me? You know that I phileo you. Isn't that weird? Jesus isn't asking, do you phileo me? Do you have an affection for me? No, he's at, do you love me? And Peter's reply is not, yes, I agape you, but I phileo you. I am very fond of you. Peter is given two opportunities now to express agape love for Jesus, and the response is lacking. Now, this could be seen as a type for all of us. Jesus says to us, do you love me? And our responses in our living is often quite a bit less than agape. I will love you if it's convenient. I'll come to church if it's convenient. I'll do what you tell me to do if it's convenient. If it doesn't bother me too much, I'll do what you tell me to do. I'll feed your lambs, or whatever that might mean. Our response is so much like Peter's. Jesus calls us to a high calling, and we tentatively say, yeah, I'm fond of you, Jesus.
Well, that's because he doesn't know what's coming.
No, he doesn't.
No.
No, he doesn't. Here's the third question. Verse 17, he said to him the third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Simon Ioannou, phileas me? Y'all understood it.
Mm-hmm.
Are you fond of me? Having asked him repeatedly, agape me? He finally says, okay, if I can't get agape in response, I'll ask phileo instead.
He's settling.
Jesus is willing to reach down to where
his
Peter
level.
Is. If Peter can't respond with agape, then I'll go to where he can respond to me with phileo. Phileas me? And then Peter felt hurt because he said to him the third time, do you love me? Note, he said to him the third time, do you love me? But he actually doesn't. The third time, he doesn't actually ask agape. He asks phileo. I thought that was a little interesting sidebar. And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. Kyrie ponte su orias, su gigonosken pate phileosi. Yes, I love you. But it's phileo love. So, first time, agape, response, phileo. Second time, agape, response, phileo. Third time, phileo, response, phileo. Jesus reaches down to where we are. Peter couldn't rise up to Jesus' calling at that time for him. So Jesus lowered the expectation, lowered the bar to where Peter could handle it. Jesus does the same thing for us. He reaches to us where we are. He has high expectations, but if we can't rise all the way to them in response immediately, then he will reach to where we can respond.
Oh, wow, that's marvelous.
That's an expression of grace. It's acceptance.
Right.
It's just like the woman caught in adultery. Neither do I condemn you. It is indeed acceptance. He reaches down to where Peter is. Later on in letters of Peter, later on in the New Testament, Peter says in the letters, I'm amazed that those who have never seen Jesus, yet they love Jesus. And here he uses the word agape. Eventually he gets to the point where he can proclaim agape back to Jesus. But right here, he ain't ready yet. He's probably still smarting over having denied Jesus. I think that is a piece of it right there. Now, it also says that Jesus doesn't give up on us if we don't quite meet his expectation the first time. He's going to try again. And he's still going to try with the high expectation. But then he's going to reach to where we are. Let's finish the paragraph. Very truly I tell you, when you were younger, you used to fasten your own belt and to go wherever you wished. I mean, you could run around all you wanted to when you were young. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will fasten a belt around you and take you where you do not wish to go. I can remember putting a belt around my dad and helping him walk down the hall because he did not have the stability just to walk around the floor at the hospital once. This strong, powerful man who used to put me to shame even when he was in his early 60s and I was a young, strapping guy. He put me to shame with what he could do, but in the end, he had to put a belt around him and then hold on to the back of that belt to keep him steady because he couldn't do it on his own. And Jesus is saying, you used to be capable of doing everything, Peter. Guess what? You're eventually going to get to the point where you're going to have to be led. Someone else will fasten a belt around you and take you where you do not wish to go. He said this to indicate the kind of death by which he would glorify God. For this he said to him, follow me. You're going to be led in a way you don't want to go, Peter. And you're going to have to do what they say. Even though you were once able to do what you wanted to do, you're going to eventually have to do what others say. And you'll eventually be led to your death by it, by simply following me.
So when he says, kind of death by which he would glorify God, they're talking about Peter.
Peter.
Okay.
Verse 19, and he said this, Jesus said this, to indicate the kind of death by which he, Peter, would glorify God. That's interesting, because nowhere in the New Testament do we have the account of Peter's execution. That actually exists in church fathers who tell us about the death of Peter. But
assassinated upside down.
That he was crucified, but upside down. Interesting.
By his choice.
In a sense,
yeah.
It was his, when he was told that, according to the tradition, when he was told he was going to be crucified, he believed it to be a great honor to die in the same way that his Lord died. And so, out of evil spite, the Romans turned him upside down on the cross.
The Romans did it.
That's the story. That's how the story goes.
Okay, yeah.
We don't know if it's historically true, but it does come from Eusebius early on in church history. So it's probably a good bet that his execution was somewhat ill-dignified in that respect. And you kind of see that here. And yet at the same time, his execution brought glory to God in a sense, because he willingly accepted that fate. He was willing to be martyred for the gospel message, and he was, just like Paul was.
Well, they were all martyred in horrible deaths, weren't they?
Except for John. John was not, he did not die a martyr's death. All the others died a martyr's death. John died an old man. In fact, there's an argument about that right in here. You want to read that? Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved. And of course the question is that John?
Yeah.
Yes, it's John, because John isn't anywhere else in the gospel. So yes, it's John. I mean, I've read book after book after book that have chapter after chapter after chapter on, is it John? Is it not John? Why wouldn't it be John? Why it isn't John? Nonsense. John isn't anywhere else in the gospel, so of course it's John. It's the only one that's... You know, one of these things is not like the other. Okay, the beloved disciple. Well, who is he? Who's the disciple that's not otherwise mentioned? John. Therefore, it's John. Have you ever remember algebra? If A equal B and B equal C, then A equal C? That's transitive? That's what you got here. Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them. He was the one who had reclined next to Jesus at the supper and had said, Lord, who is it that is going to betray you? Another way we know it's John, by the way. Then, when Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, Lord, what about him? If I'm going to have to die in a way that glorifies God, what about him?
Sounds like a little kid.
Yeah. In fact, the disciples are often depicted as children.
Mm-hmm.
They are often children. Jesus said to him, if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? Follow me. So the rumor spread in the community that this disciple would not die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he would not die, but if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? Now that's a very fascinating statement right there.
Sure is.
This is the portion of the gospel, one of the portions of the gospel that could not, if John is the author of John, and I believe that John is the author of large chunks of John, this part isn't. It's this editorial remark. The rumor was that John was going to live until Jesus returned. He's an old man, he still hasn't died, and we're now past the period where all of the other disciples are dead. we're in the 90s AD and John's still alive, my goodness gracious, he's going to live until Jesus comes. Well, apparently a big chunk of this gospel may have been written by then. Then John actually died. And people said, but I thought he was going to live until Jesus came. Jesus said it himself. And so they wrote into the gospel, no, it didn't say that. Jesus did say, if it's, you know, my will, what is that to you? Follow me. But that little parenthetical note is absolutely hilarious. So the rumor spread in the community that this disciple would not die. Actually, that brothers is the literal word there.
He's kind of sassy sometimes, wasn't he?
Who?
Jesus.
Yeah. What worse was Peter and John and their continual back at each other. So the rumor spread in the community, amongst the brothers rather, that this disciple would not die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he would not die, but if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? Other ancient authorities lack, what is that to you? That's a...
That's the little sarcastic part.
Jesus being sassy there. This, verse 24, this is the disciple who is testifying to these things and has written them. And we know that his testimony is true. Well, right there, you know, you can tell any fundamentalist tells you that John wrote all the John's gospel. Well, no, he didn't. Look at verse 24 of chapter 21. Mm-hmm. That is definitely not written in first person by John, nor in a third person by John, trying to claim, you know, some step away from the story. Mm-hmm. And we know that his testimony is true. Who's the we speaking here, friends? Is God telling whoever's writing this to lie? No. So, this is an affirmation made by John's community that eventually edited and published the whole gospel, that John is the source for a lot of this.
But right. A lot of it sounds like it's written in the third person.
Yes. Now, that is actually a characteristic of ancient authorship, that you didn't normally write in first person. That was a little weird. Back then, today it sounds weird if we write about ourselves in the third person. It took me forever to write a bio of myself in which I didn't write in first person and wrote it instead in third person. It took me a long time to learn how to do that and not feel weird. Mm-hmm. Autobiography in that respect can be very difficult if you don't write it in first person. But in the ancient world, the opposite was true. You didn't write in first person, you wrote in third. And we still see that echoed today in the royal we, that the queen, when the queen says, we are not amused. Well, she doesn't have a mouse in her pocket. She's speaking of her royal self. And that royal statement gives you some authority and power if you use the third person. Well, that is actually an echo of an ancient practice that you never refer to yourself in the first person. Not formally. Not in writing either. And that's kind of why we would see that elsewhere throughout the gospel. But I happen to think that John's gospel received a massive, thorough edit. But that much of the stories and accounts come from John himself in one way or another. But that they were edited together and given their final form as we see here. And this is a clear piece of that. But where are those... Let's read the whole paragraph again, because this is the very end of the gospel. This is the disciple who is testifying to these things and has written them, and we know that his testimony is true. So this is the affirmation of the community, probably written after John's death. But there are also many other things that Jesus did. If every one of them were written down, I suppose world itself could not contain the books that would be written. That could either be a quote, actually. Mm-hmm. It is in the first person, and it is unusual, but that's there. So it shifts from third to first, from we, plural, mm-hmm. to first, singular. That's weird. Mm-hmm. And that has led some scholars to think that that's actually a quotation. Maybe John at some time said, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written if all of Jesus' stories and teachings were written down. Some people also believe, and I think it's true, that this reflects a knowledge of the Johannine community, if not John himself, of the existence of the other three Gospels. Why does John not contain lots of the stories that are found in the other Gospels? Well, because those are the other Gospels.
They've already been written.
They've been written. They tell other stories. This Gospel was written to tell these stories about Jesus, to give this perspective about Jesus. And there's nothing wrong with multiple versions of the same story.
You have been listening to a Bible study by Dr. Gregory Neal, Senior Pastor of St. Stephen United Methodist Church and Rector of Grace Incarnate Ministries. Copyright 2007 by Dr. Gregory S. Neal. All rights reserved. For more information or to listen to other seminars, Bible studies, or sermons by Dr. Gregory Neal, visit us on the web at www.revneal.org. That's www.revneal.org. You are also invited to visit us in person at St. Stephen United Methodist Church, 2520 Oates Drive, Mesquite, Texas, 75150. This program was produced by Dr. Greg Neal.